AT&T 4G LTE network? Great. A free pamphlet on transcendental enlightenment you got from a weird guy at the airport? Not great. So, this holiday season, give the greatest free gift you can give by giving that special someone a free ZTE Maven 2 when you activate eligible service from AT&T GoPhone for $30. Don't give them a free keychain from Big Mo's Muffler or a handful of after-dinner mints. Free? Yes. Gift-worthy? No. So hurry into AT&T for the best free gift of the holiday season.
All plans 12/31/16 online in select locations only. Requires new line of service and minimum $30 payment. 4G LTE not available everywhere. Taxes, fees, coverage, and other restrictions apply. Details at att.com/gophone.
From the WGCH Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans with your Doppler weather radar forecast. WGCH brings you up-to-the-minute weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Wind advisory in effect today all day long till 10 o'clock tonight. The gusts have been from 30 to 40 and at times 50 miles an hour this afternoon. Temperature is around 43, but it feels like 30. It feels like 20 to our north and west. Tonight, the winds will still be cranking. 30-mile-per-hour wind gusts tonight to 40. This is meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans for 1490 WGCH.
Business Talk with Jim Gamble every Monday night at 6. Interviews with leading figures from the worlds of business, politics, and sports. He's a Charlie Rose on radio, according to Lawrence McDonald, author of the definitive book on the fall of Lehman. Jim is the gold standard in broadcasting, says New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker. Listen to Business Talk with Jim Campbell every Monday night at 6, right after the Lisa Wexler Show on 1490 WGCH and WGCH.com anywhere. The opinions expressed in our talk shows are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio. And now, the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour on 1490 WGCH.
Good afternoon. This is Beth O'Malley on Be Well with Beth at the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour, WGCH 1490 or WGCH.com from anywhere. Anywhere, I should say. This week,
look
I
at
am
you. That was good.
That was slick, right? Until the anywhere.
No, the anywhere was the part that made me think, wow, she continues to get. I don't need a job anymore. Go ahead.
Thank you, Rob. This week, we are here with Molly Ashcroft. She is a young woman in long-term recovery from addiction, and she is going to share with us. I'm going to be asking you tons of questions today about your family history, about your life history, about how it came to be that you ended up in a situation where you were addicted to both substances and also alcoholism. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And what's really special about Molly is that she's also the director of admissions at Westport House, which is a transitional sober living facility for young men. So we'll be talking a little bit more about the program in a moment. I wanted to just let you know that in 2 weeks, I have Dr. Sonia Mehra coming on to talk about pediatric issues. The week after that, I'll have Tom Nash on, and he'll be talking about acupuncture. Tom is one of the top acupuncturists in the psychiatric community in terms of working with psychiatric disorders, and he trains acupuncturists throughout New York City on treatment of psychiatric disorders with, and substance abuse, of course, with acupuncture, which
Amazing.
Is incredible.
Yeah.
And then we have a few other folks that are lined up. I'm looking forward to, around the holidays, having Rebecca Camizio, Dr. Camizio, come in from Stanwich School, and she'll be talking about children and stress during the holidays. I also have been talking with one of the local therapists that Dr. Ratner about borderline personality disorder and sharing a little bit more clinically about what a personality disorder is versus depression or anxiety.
And I think how that affects substance use disorders as well, because there's a lot of folks out there, young adults all the way to older adults, that suffer from dual diagnosis, maybe primary being mental health, but have a secondary substance use disorder.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in terms of the co-occurring disorders, we had just had a wonderfully successful program in town About 2 weeks ago, run by the high school, the United Way, and I helped to co-sponsor that with Liberation House. And it was a workshop called Stress, Success, and Teenage Setbacks, Let's Talk. And what we do is bring the teens from the high school out for the evening for this workshop where everyone shares their stories. It's incredible to see kids who are still in high school sharing their personal stories. And we'll be doing that twice a year, so I'll let you know when the next
amazing.
One is.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's really fun. Okay, so a little bit more about Molly. She went to work for Westport House after gaining really a nice, solid recovery program and really living a sober life. You don't just jump into working in a treatment facility when you're coming out of your own struggle. Your struggle was absolutely incredible to hear you share with me about when I met you a few years ago, because you started quite young and really had experienced a lot of different things that many youth maybe are experiencing that we as parents don't know. Can you share a little bit about your first experience in terms of your first substance use?
Sure. So, you know, growing up, you know, pretty in an affluent area, I grew up in Guilford, came from a loving home with two parents. I was the oldest of four kids. And I can always remember thinking, I'm not going to drink and I'm not going to use drugs and I'm not going to smoke cigarettes, right? And I think that aligns with a lot of people's experience who we find in recovery today and in past years. And what I found when I drank the first time, I think I was probably about 14 or 15 years old. So for me, it progressed very quickly. But the first time I drank, I can't say that I was like, oh, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life, but I can definitely say it produced an effect that I enjoyed, right? It gave me some sort of relief, some sort of, you know, I could take a breath and I wasn't seeking something else, because it was always what's next, what's next, what's next in my life. I felt like I was always chasing something as an adolescent and not getting what I wanted. I would reach for something else. And so that drink kind of just gave me the ability to breathe a little bit deeper and say, you know, maybe this is what it's about, to kind of experiment. And that's kind of where it started. At a friend's house, mixed a bunch of alcohol together out of their parents' liquor cabinet. I think that is parallel to many people's experience.
Right.
Had access to it.
What grade were you in? Do you recall?
Sophomore in high school.
Oh, so you were in high school at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've often heard in my practice when someone describes that first experience, sometimes now we're even hearing middle school.
Well, I think I was given the first like sip of alcohol probably when I was like 5 or 6 years old by my grandmother. And then like again when I was maybe like 9 or 10.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't, you know, at that point, I don't think I really kind of comprehended what it was. It wasn't until I, you know, made the decision, right? Because you make a decision at some point to take a drink to, you know, gain an effect of what your other peers are discussing that it produces.
And when working with teenagers, one of the tough parts for me is that there's this description by teens when they're intoxicated of really feeling on top of the world, better than they ever felt before. You know, I can do anything. Everyone suddenly likes me.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I think that happens as you progress with substances and alcohol. I don't know if that happened so much for me on the first drink, but as I began to experience with marijuana and drinking at parties, now all of a sudden boys were paying attention to me. I started dating an older guy, was surrounded by people that I may not necessarily have jived with prior, but now were paying attention to me because I either brought something to the table, whether that be alcohol or marijuana, or I brought money to the table or mm-hmm. whatever the case may be. So people start to flock towards you, and then that gives you a sense of camaraderie that maybe you've been searching for a long time. Because as we know, in the public school system or private school system, wherever your child lands, it has become more and more cliquey and mm-hmm. Judgmental and such, you know, a lot of bullying going on in schools. So really to feel a part of a group and feel safe and protected by that gives you a level of confidence that maybe I necessarily didn't have before I took that drink.
Right. Right. And I can't tell you how many 11 and 12-year-old girls, when I run the Positively More workshops, talk about the word popularity as if, I mean, it's the way I might say I'm going to get a cup of coffee. Popularity comes out of their mouth throughout the workshops throughout the day, and it's all a sense of everyone else is popular but me. Even the children who are deemed popular are not necessarily identifying as popular. So if suddenly I'm drinking and with a party group and there's this group that everyone wants to go out on Friday night and we're all going to go together and, you know, I'm going to fit in that way, that can give a false sense of popularity.
No, absolutely. And I think the disconnect that an alcoholic suffers from, or somebody who's afflicted with addiction suffers from, is that, you know, the disconnect between me and the rest of the world and feeling separated from even at Christmas dinner with my family. So, you know, being able to feel a part of when we take that drink, it you know, loosens us up, gives us a level of confidence, you know, we're able to talk a little bit more freely and, you know, feel, you know, comfortable in our own bodies. There's a lot of transitions that go on in high school as for mm-hmm. for young adult females,
yeah.
And males, but more so females, of, you know, what I'm supposed to look like, how I'm supposed to dress, what car I'm supposed to drive, who I'm supposed to date, and all that kind of falls to the wayside when I drank, you know, based on my allergic reaction to alcohol.
Right. Right. Now, I very much appreciate your using that term, allergic reaction to alcohol, because what we know about addiction and alcoholism is in families is that there really, in many families, is a type of an allergic response to alcohol from the beginning. Can you speak a little bit to the impact of alcohol on other family members?
Yeah, sure. So my dad's been in long-term recovery for 24, 25 years now, and I was well aware of the allergy that he had developed to alcohol, as well as my uncle, my grandmother. I have a cousin. I have uncles, aunts. So I was well aware that there was alcoholism that ran in my family. And I was brought up that I definitely ran the risk, right? My siblings and I all ran the risk. Unfortunately or fortunately, I'm the one who ended up with, you know, I believe a gene that, you know, I had the genetic predisposition to alcoholism as opposed to some of my other siblings. But, you know, looking at it, you never think that you're going to be like that. You know, I see my dad, you know, having to leave dinner early to go to a support group, or, you know, having to meet with a friend of his who is his support for his alcoholism. And for me, what looked way more attractive was my mom sitting at dinner having a glass of wine. And that's really what I sought out to be like, right? I sought out to be like her.
Yeah.
And failed miserably, as you'll hear probably as we go forth with my story. But
and I'm just calculating the math. Our listeners don't know that you're 29. So
29.
If we reduce, if you were 5 when Dad got sober.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Do you remember him drinking?
No.
That's interesting, too, because here you're living with someone in active recovery mm-hmm. from addiction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And being exposed to probably open AA meetings, anniversary celebrations, sponsors, and then eventually your dad may have sponsored other people and have sponsees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was never – I don't remember my dad actively drinking. I do remember my uncle having a significant problem with drugs and alcohol and, you know, his mood and his affect being quite erratic at times throughout my childhood. But for my dad, I would say that he maintained a pretty soft demeanor with us as children. And he also worked in Manhattan every day. So my mom was a stay-at-home mom. And a lot of what kind of went on with his drinking was not really open to the family. He hid it from most.
I've had I've worked with adult children of alcoholics, which we also refer to as an ACOA, adult child of addiction or alcoholism. And I have a few clients who were in their 20s before they discovered that they had a parent that was alcoholic, despite extraordinary advanced stages of alcoholism, DUIs, being admitted into the hospital because of being so intoxicated they couldn't function. And yet there was a way that the one parent protected the active alcoholic. In other words, that parent maybe didn't come home that night, but they were staying in the city at a hotel or what have you, for, you know, oh, daddy's on a business trip. And there are kids who find it almost hard to believe that when they look at the personality characteristics, and I give, whenever there's a family history of addiction, I right away get out Janet Woidett's book, Adult Children of Alcoholics, because there are 13 characteristics that a child will look, an adult child will look at and say, well, how do I have 9 of those 13? I didn't even know that my dad drank every night.
Right, right. And it is something that you don't necessarily remember or see as a young child, unless the behavior was super erratic, and it wasn't. My dad maintained a level of neutrality around the household, and so it was something that I never really was affected by, which is, you know, positive, at least. It didn't protect me at all from my own alcoholism, but...
Mm-hmm. Just looking at your first treatment experience, I'd like to talk a little bit about that. It happened to be at the Karen Foundation, which is where I had my first clinical job.
Okay.
So we'll talk a little bit about that. What I want to do first is take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about the experience of treatment as an adolescent going from facility to facility to facility. Okay. And the struggle that that was for you in trying to change your life.
Sure.
All right. Thank you so much, Molly. This is Beth O'Malley with the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour at WGCH 1490.
From the WGCH Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans with your Doppler weather radar forecast. WGCH brings you up-to-the-minute weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Wind advisory in effect today all day long till 10 o'clock tonight. The gusts have been from 30 to 40 and at times 50 miles an hour this afternoon. Temperature is around 43, but it feels like 30. It feels like 20 to our north and west. Tonight, the winds will still be cranking. 30 mile per hour wind gusts tonight to 40. This is meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans for 1490. WGCH.
This is Margaret Walsh of Greenwich Library. With the ever-increasing cost of tuition, can you afford to put your children through college? While there are many different ways to finance higher education, parents often feel like they need to choose between risking their retirement and burying their children in debt. If this sounds familiar, you should attend How to Pay for College Without Bankrupting You or Your Children. Presented by CCPS financial planner Sean Flynn, this class will explore topics such as applying for financial aid sources and working with financial aid offices, saving for college and finding colleges that fit your budget, alternative payment options, and so much more. This program will take place Thursday, December 1st at 6 p.m. in the second floor meeting room of the main library. Registration is highly encouraged. Please visit the library's event calendar at www.greenwichlibrary.org to register. I'm Margaret Walsh of Greenwich Library on 1490 WGCH.
Good afternoon on this cold Monday afternoon. This is Beth O'Malley at the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour at 1490 WGCH or WGCH anywhere. And I am here hosting the show Be Well with Beth. Today I have with me Molly Ashcroft, who is recovering from substance abuse, including drug addiction as well as alcoholism. And she is working at the Westport facility. So welcome back.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the difference in treatment and then your experience in seeking treatment. But let's first talk about the different levels of care, because there's inpatient care, where one, in the old days, it was always, 28 days.
Right.
20 years ago, if you had any kind of abuse of alcohol or substances, you went for 28 days and that was that.
Yeah, and I think that whole model is effective to a degree, but I think the wave of 28-day inpatient treatment is hopefully, you know, going to be abbreviated by most. 28 days inpatient is a good start, but is definitely not enough in our experience at Westport House, which is a transitional living for young men. and we are an extended care program. So what we have found is that, you know, residential anywhere from 30, 60, or 90 days is a great starting point to be able to sober up, to be able to stabilize, to be able to make initial contact with clinicians and really have a psych evaluation, kind of determine what the diagnosis is, whether it's substance use disorder or a possible dual diagnosis. But that's really just the tipping point, because the reality is that most people who struggle with substance abuse do not know how to live sober. So how do we go from inpatient to maybe a basic sober house with not a whole lot of structure, little to no oversight, maybe an occasional urinalysis test. But for the most part, that level of care has seemed to be ineffective from going from the most structure to the least amount of structure.
Right.
And exactly. So that's where transitional livings come in. That is where intensive outpatient comes in, outpatient level of care. So there's a variety of different levels of care that fall on the continuum for substance use.
Absolutely. And sometimes when a client comes in for outpatient, in my assessment or in any outpatient psychotherapist's assessment, we determine that for that person to really start the process of recovery, the first step may be a detox hospital. So that's extremely acute. You would start with detox maybe for 3 days, maybe for a week and a half, and move from a detox program possibly to an inpatient stay. It could be 2 weeks, but it could be 6 to 12 weeks. It depends on the needs. And today, families, facilities and insurance are all working together as best as they can.
Or trying to.
They're trying to, right? in terms of coming up with a customized plan that meets the need of that individual. Then from a program inpatient, I would say about 95% of the time, most of my clients are then referred for an outpatient experience, but not necessarily, I shouldn't say outpatient, another experience.
Right.
And oftentimes it's a halfway house, a sober living like Westport House.
Right.
Sometimes they'll be referred home into an IOP, but my experience is that most folks are staying sober longer or clean from substances longer, even if they come in and the presenting problem is just marijuana and they're not drinking and not using other drugs. I still find that 3 to 6 months at a transitional living solidifies recovery.
Well, I think because it lays the foundation, right? And so I'm a byproduct of extended care. I believe in it. That's why I work in this level of care. I really believe in the model. And the reason being is because the last relationships to heal when somebody's struggling from a substance use disorder is the family. The family has been most affected. The emotions are heightened. If there's siblings involved, parents involved, cousins, whatever the case may be, there's a lot of the family dynamic is pretty broken. And to be able to repair that, everyone has to be a part of that journey. So another big piece of Westport House and what we try to deliver to each family is that it is going to be a family process, and you are going to be required as the family to have your own journey separate from your son. And so what that really means is engaging in support groups, engaging in your own therapy, engaging in the family program we offer, engaging with the case manager to share your concerns, your feelings. Because a lot of the time, parents want to ship their child off to from here to California to get fixed, quotes unquotes, and to have an experience with inpatient treatment and then come back and be the son that they remembered when he was maybe 13 years old, excelling in sports and academics. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that he may be 22 years old now, has had failed attempts at school, is not able to maintain sobriety, and that no way can that be dealt with or healed in a 28-day period.
Right. And what I like about Westport House is you're really helping men get back to life with the skills of just everyday living. You know, at the hospital, we call them ADLs, but just, you know, in terms of when I get up, I brush my teeth.
Right.
Just the basics of how do I take care of myself on top of a foundation in recovery in order to position them for long-term success. And that's really the premise of your program. Your founder is in recovery himself.
Yep.
And that's Al.
Al Samaras is our executive director, who founded Westport House in 2014 with really a mission that encompassed intimate, individualized treatment slash program, right? So the goal was to keep an environment small enough that we could really pay attention to the individual's needs, because there's a variety of different ways of how people get sober. And that was really what Al drove home, is that how he got sober may not be the same as how someone else gets sober.
Right.
And so encompassing different types of activities, case managers, personalities, to really wrap around the client with a whole team, including a master's level clinician, a case manager, a psychiatrist, and 24/7 staffing, to say, hey, what your journey may look like may be a little bit different from your roommates, but we all have a common bond, which is that we feel separated from when we are sober. Mm-hmm. And how are we going to live our life with purpose so we no longer need to turn to drugs and alcohol when life is overwhelming? So through academics, through education, through volunteer services, through a part-time job, and slowly but surely raising the level of confidence among this demographic of young men or young women, wherever the case may be. Because when they do come in, they come in pretty broken. And just like I came in broken and Al came in broken and a majority of our staff who are in long-term recovery came in broken, how did we nurture that and gain our confidence back and gain, you know, really a full heart? Because it's really pretty disheveled.
Right. And then also, I love the way the program, and most programs today, really and bring the family into treatment as well. When families first approach us for care for a loved one who's addicted, the first thing I say is, well, as AA is for the alcoholic and NA is for the narcotic or drug user, Al-Anon or Nar-Anon is for the family member who is affected and impacted by their loved one's use. And it's crucial to recovery, because if you have a child away, you know, as you said, in California, and they come home and they move right back into the family, the dynamics between parents, siblings, and the child are still as dysfunctional as they were when that child went to treatment, because the family has not necessarily sought treatment. And the most success we have is when the facility, for example, I have a family who had their daughter go out to Arizona for a long-term extended stay. And the treatment provider said to the parents, you must be in therapy. You must be in couples, parents, therapy together in order for us to work with your daughter.
Well, I think, too, is that the parents, this has been their full-time job, right?
Right.
And this has been their role, to pick up the pieces for their child. So when the child actually gets and stays sober, they don't really know. This is what they've wanted for however many years. But they don't really know how to interact, and they don't really know what their role is.
Right.
And also, I think what's affected a lot is the marriage, right?
Right. The
stress of the relationship between parents.
And also the self-doubt and self-blame.
Right.
Because I have to tell you, some of the most wonderful parents that I have ever met have a child who's addicted.
Mm-hmm.
That's not because they did a bad job parenting.
Right. And I try to drive that home to parents, because a lot of parents would, you know, almost rather their child have a mental health diagnosis than a substance use disorder diagnosis. And, you know, there's many efforts going on throughout the country right now to try to destigmatize addiction, which
right.
I think is very mm-hmm. important. But it's important for the parents to take a look at, you know, have someone help them take a look. Because the delusion is pretty thick within our own minds of what's really going on and what's true and what's false and how to navigate that and be able to have their own healing experience through that.
Now, what we haven't touched on too much is the 12-step programs of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the program really stemmed from two men who were meeting, and Dr. Bob
and Bill Wilson.
And Bill Wilson, yeah. And they were up in Vermont, I believe,
mm-hmm.
Ludlow area. And that program has now branched out across the entire world.
Right.
And is available to anyone, anywhere. A client who comes in for alcohol abuse or alcoholism these days usually already knows all about AA, but there's this preconceived notion that it's not for them. That seems to be across the board these days.
Right.
Right? So how do you address that?
Well, I was just talking about this last night to a group of people when I was out to dinner, and I think that, first of all, I was very much a believer of the same, right? That it was great for fellowship and it was great to meet people, but that solution wouldn't work for me. And I think the biggest my biggest problem, I should say, was that I felt like I got myself in this problem and I can get myself out. We're very stubborn as humans to be able to see it in a different light. And although I am not going to force anyone against their own will to do anything, right? It is up to them to have their own experience. But as they start to see other people who are recovering happy, sober, and free, mm-hmm. that's when they'll start to get on board. And typically that happens 99.9% of the time. You know, there's always the 0.1% that maybe, you know, is looking to go a different avenue or a different support group. And we encourage that, you know, if whatever's going to work for them. But I would encourage people who have not, you know, given it a shot to say, you know, look at all the other people that it has worked for, and that it can be a part of your process. It doesn't have to be it entirely.
Absolutely. Well, what I'd like to do is ask, in your first treatment experience, you went away inpatient.
Mm-hmm. I had an intervention done on me.
Oh, so there was a formal intervention done with your family?
And many others.
Did they bring in friends or coworkers?
They brought in my the head of the dance studio. I had competed for 12 years all across the country. The head of the dance studio was there. Cousins, grandparents, mom and dad.
Wow.
It was pretty large.
That's pretty intense.
Uh-huh.
How did that go over with you?
Did not go over well.
I wouldn't think. And of course, you had a professional running that.
We did. It was my therapist that I'd been seeing for 2 years and being dishonest with. And she hosted it. And that was back in 2005. And at the time, I just was not in a position where I felt like I would, I wasn't at a place in my life, and I got there later on down the road where I hit many more bottoms throughout my journey of addiction. But, you know, what I can say is that at the time, I wasn't really willing to throw it all away and not live that double life. I was willing to take advantage of the opportunity that they were presenting and go away to treatment. And so, you know, what I thought was going to be 2 weeks right outside New York City was a treatment center in Pennsylvania, and I was there for 4 months as an adolescent. And that's where I started my process.
Okay. Well, we will come right back and talk about the adolescent program at Karen Foundation. And I actually, ironically, have them scheduled for March to come on the show. And so we're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back. This is Beth O'Malley with the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour at WGCH.com or WGCH 1490.
From the WGCH Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans with your Doppler weather radar forecast. WGCH brings you up-to-the-minute weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Wind advisory in effect today all day long till 10 o'clock tonight. The gusts have been from 30 to 40 and at times 50 miles an hour this afternoon. Temperature is around 43, but it feels like 30. It feels like 20 to our north and west. Tonight, the winds will still be cranking. 30 mile per hour wind gusts tonight to 40. This is meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans for 1490. WGCH.
For 2 hours, every Thursday night at 6, listen in and even converse with the man in the know regarding all matters Greenwich. Listen to Sam Romeo's show, Greenwich Matters, brought to you by Parsonage, where their philosophy is to assist you in living life your way. From the beach to the backcountry, education, recreation, or politics, learn all about it on Greenwich Matters, every Thursday night from 6 to 8 p.m. on 1490 WGCH.
Good afternoon. This is Beth O'Malley on Be Well with Beth at the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour, 1490 WGCH. And I am here today with Molly Ashcroft from the Westport Sober House. And we are talking about recovery and addiction, substance abuse, including both drugs and alcohol, and the impact on the family. So where we left off, Molly had gone for treatment after an intervention by her family. Family, friends, dance company, cousins, everyone was really there. It was a tough experience, as most interventions are when they're done beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
From an intervention, generally speaking, you hop in a car and you're driven right to where you're going, and your suitcase has already been packed by the time that the family sits down to talk with you with the professional in the room. We strongly recommend interventions never be done by just the family without a professional. And I think, unfortunately, nowadays with this TV show Intervention, everyone thinks they can do it themselves because they're watching the reality show, and that's not, you know, even on the show, they use professionals, and there's a very important reason for that. from treatment and you still had a few more rehabs ahead of you in your journey. So yeah. What happened? Were you sober for a period of time after those weeks?
Not really. So I believe substances were my issue. So cocaine and other substances that I had really landed in inpatient for at the Karen Foundation. And I wanted to be able to drink and smoke pot like my friends, you know. And so I kind of sought out to do that and really developed that to be my main mission in life, right? Which is crazy. But that's the delusion.
And sorry to interrupt, but let me ask you, earlier you spoke about alcohol and then starting to experiment with marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was cocaine?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
And so by the time you got to Karen, those were the three substances that you had used?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. And so when I got there, you know, I had a positive experience. I mean, I felt like they were great and they educated me on the disease of addiction and what that looked like and the way it had affected my family and relationships. And they do a very strong family education program for 5 days that my parents attended.
Oh, your parents went through Chit Chat. What year?
So they went through the family program, which is the intensive program actually at the adolescent unit just for the parents.
Okay.
So they went through that as well as one of my siblings, and that's where we kind of expose our drug history, which is very humbling, and really start to kind of dive into that work. And so what happened when I got out was that I just really was not fully – I did not fully concede to my innermost self that I really had an issue with alcohol and marijuana. I felt like it was if I could stay away from the other substances that I would be okay. If I could stay away from cocaine, you know, that's really what brought me to my knees. That's what, you know, forced me to lie and cheat and steal from my family. And that just wasn't the case. And so after that, I did relapse and I pretty much, my parents drew a very firm boundary. And if I can say anything to families, it is that to A, get professional help and talk to providers before you make a decision on what to do with your child who's addicted, but also to maintain healthy boundaries. And the healthy boundaries that my parents put in place is you can either stay in this house and be sober or you can leave. And I then bounced around for the next 5 years in and out of inpatient treatment centers and detoxes and less than livable conditions. And
how old were you when you were going in and out of detoxes?
17 to 21.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because then it escalated to opiates, which it always does.
Yeah.
Typically.
Yeah. No, that's what I see here.
Yeah.
So when was your first opiate use?
I dabbled in opiates probably when I was about 18 and I didn't really love them. And then I got into a relationship with a man who, that was his thing. And that's really when it took off. To be able to come down from the uppers, you use opiates and it's this constant cycle. So you're always chasing. You either want to be up or you want to be down. You want to be up or you want to be down. And so it just became this revolving door that's really hard to break. You know, and especially when you're physically addicted to opiates, you never want to be sick. You don't want to be uncomfortable. So that's what, you know, obviously extended my, you know, detox stints.
And can you describe what that looks like? So to a, for example, if you were in front of your parents, what would they see when you were high?
They would see, you know, my pupils very pinned. So, you know, almost non-existent, the pupils. They would see that I was probably really fidgety, uncomfortable in my own skin. My mom could always tell by the color of the whites of my eyes. And that's just my mom, and maybe that would be different for other people. Oh, but she knew when I was sober, my eyes would be a lot more clear in the whites of my eyes. And when I was using, they would be a bit more, you know, dim and, you know, almost lifeless, I would say.
Yeah. I'm going to post a picture of us later, as I had mentioned to you, where people can see you have extremely bright eyes.
Thank you.
And very, very white whites. So I can see where if they were red all of a sudden, you would probably notice that. Now, when I think of opioids, you know, my number one go-to in my head is Oxy. Was that your drug of choice?
Well, that was my first, you know, my first experiment with opiates was OxyContin back in 2006 when the OxyContin was rampant.
Yes.
And then from there, it went to Percocets and I would dabble with those a little bit and then eventually leading to heroin.
How old were you when you first tried heroin?
I was probably about 19 years old.
At that point, where were you in your life? Because the heroin addicts locally that I've worked with are actually at really good colleges, actually quite successful, getting fairly decent grades. And that's what's always disheartening and concerning.
Well, I had chosen, my parents were not supporting school unless I could stay sober, and I was not maintaining sobriety, so I was not able to go to Boston to where I had been accepted originally. So at this point, I was at a state university, but I was bouncing around. I could maintain a job. I had a great work ethic when I was using, but I wasn't.
Because you needed the money for the substances.
Yeah, of course. Right.
Okay.
So you're constantly a hard worker. And so that kind of carried me, right? And I would go on to put stints of sobriety together, maybe a couple months, and I would do okay, and I would hold my breath for a certain amount of time until I would resort back to drinking and using drugs, because no mental defense, right? So if I'm not working a solution and I don't have the proper supports in place, it's only a matter of time before I return. And I think that's the biggest piece, is that what people are missing coming from inpatient back to minimal structure is that it takes a while to create those supports and allow yourself to be vulnerable enough with another person to tell them where you're at.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big part of it. You know, I remember, and this is also a red flag for parents to be aware of, you know, when you ask your kid how they're doing or what their goals are or anything, and they're very short responses, like, how are you doing? And the response is, I'm fine. I would say that's a red flag. That's what I always told my parents, just because I wanted to brush them off and do what I wanted to do.
Right.
You know, so it's to have open communication with your children.
Right. Were you having any outbursts of anger at home or rage?
All the time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I think.
Anger, rage, missing money.
Yeah.
You know,
missing jewelry,
erratic behavior with my siblings.
Were you ever physically violent with your siblings?
Oh, I'm sure I was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, they're upset and they're, you know, not wanting to speak to me, and I'm trying to get my point across or trying to plead with them that things are going to be different or whatever the case may be, you know, a variety of different reasons. And that's really the ultimate, you know, was the ultimate, you know, goal for my parents was, you cannot live here and disrupt this entire household like you have been doing for,
right,
you know, the past few years, because they have a life too and they need to go to school and they need to pursue their education and their goals. And it's not fair that we're taking all this energy and putting it towards you when we have three other children.
Yeah. What's your birth order?
I'm the oldest.
Oh, okay.
Really paved the way, you know?
Yeah. Let me ask you this. We always talk about a bottom. What did your bottom look like? And I know the answer, and I think that listeners will be surprised.
So the end of my addiction and my bottom looked as such as me homeless in the not so nice area of New Haven, Fairhaven, living out of a car, out of a dealer's parking lot, and really desperate and broken and just really living to use and using to live. I really like that slogan because I feel like it just really depicts what the alcoholic addict life looks like towards the end.
Right.
No communication with my family. The only communication would be that if I wanted treatment. And for a long time, I didn't want treatment, and I just kind of resided to the fact that this was going to be my life because, you know, for the listeners that, you know, are with us today, you know, there was, you know, 12 failed treatment attempts prior to that.
Right.
So eventually you get tired of going inpatient treatment.
Yeah.
You know?
And you know inpatient treatment. Once you're that savvy, you know exactly what the therapist is going to ask
you. Of course.
You next.
Mm-hmm. And my therapist would call my parents and be like, she's doing great. And my mom would be like screaming on the other end of the line, no, she's not. She's lying to you.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Because I can do really well in inpatient treatment. It's really what happens after.
Yeah.
And that's where I stress the importance of extended care.
And that's why extended care is so crucial. And I have, you know, children who are inpatient for 4 weeks, 6 weeks. 8 weeks and ready to come home, and the counselor says or they go to a wilderness program,
right,
and ready to come home, and the parents call me up in a panic because the counselor at the program is recommending you know, what we often refer to as a halfway house. And, you know, why do they need to go? I just paid $60,000 mm-hmm. that the insurance isn't going to cover, and now the therapist is trying to And there's this thinking that it's to scam me, that my kid has to go away. Can't they just come home and we'll watch them like a hawk, and they'll go to 12-step meetings, we'll have them get a sponsor, they'll see you. I don't care, they can see you 3 times a week. And I'll say, I would love to see your child 3 times a week, but if that's not the best course of treatment, which in this case it's not, because a treatment facility is recommending extended care where they're in a safe living environment with peers so that a child learns to live on their own in an in a social environment, as opposed to just living in basically a hospital.
Right. Well, I think that's the biggest component that you just said, is living on their own. How many parents take their children back after inpatient treatment, and what type of level of confidence is that truly building for the young adult? Because who we're dealing with is a young adult who should be at school, living independently, being able to maintain their laundry
right.
and their, you know, shower schedule, and being
right.
able to function in
get out of bed,
in real
go
world,
to your job,
in the real
eat
world,
breakfast.
Correct? Yeah, and so it's a lot of those skills that most of us have not really practiced sober, because we've been so accustomed to waking up and how am I not going to be sick? I need to use drugs and alcohol, you know. So it's really starting to gain that traction and really start to implement all the skills that they've learned inpatient, but in an extended care program, so they're slowly start to see what that's going to look like and really set the tone for the future.
Right. So when you hit bottom, you were living out of your car.
Mm-hmm. Well, somebody else's car. But yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm.
My parents wouldn't give me a car.
They wouldn't give you. So you manipulated to get a car from someone else?
Well, it was a guy that I had been seeing for a while. Okay. So it was both him and I.
So you were both living in it together. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So go ahead. And then what happened?
What happened? I woke up one day sick, just as I always did. And I just really had a glimmer. And when I say moments of clarity are very brief, I work with families, those who are addicted, those who have been affected by addiction. Everyone's moments of clarity are very, very brief. And I had one of those that morning, and I said, you know, I just maybe this doesn't have to be my life forever. And I picked up the phone and I called my dad, because that's what I do.
Yeah.
My mother's in Al-Anon, so we don't call her. I'm not saying that that's not a great support for families, because it is, but she was very firm on her boundaries. And I knew if anybody was going to answer the phone, it would be my dad.
Yeah.
And he made me wait. He made me wait till the following day. And he said, you know, if you really have the willingness, then you'll meet me at this location tomorrow. And, you know, I couldn't argue with him. There were many a times that I called him and said, I want help. And then I drop off the face of the planet for 3 weeks, you know?
Yeah, right.
And so that moment of clarity. But of course, when you hang up the phone after you make that call, you're like, oh, it's not that bad, you know? And you justify of how you're going to get yourself out of the problem. But for some reason, that moment, that just carried me through to the next day. And I met my family, and that was the start to when I was placed in an extended care program out of state.
Okay. And so you went right, because you'd had enough inpatient treatment experiences, you were able to go right into an extended care facility.
Yeah, and most places won't do that, but the facility that I was being transitioned to had known me. I had been on their roster to come in a couple times, and they knew my family, and they said, you know, if you could keep her for a couple days until she starts to feel a little bit better, then we will take her when she's stable. And they did.
And how long were you there?
How long was I at that program?
Mm-hmm.
I was there for 4 months, and honestly, I probably could have stayed longer, but that was the length of stay for that program back in 2008.
Oh, okay.
The
extended care is generally longer these days.
Yeah, so typically 6 to 12 months now. Back then it was 4 months, but I stayed in that area for 2 years.
Got it.
So I stayed close, and I stayed with people who were in the program, and I stayed with people who had long-term sobriety, and I learned to navigate this world pretty much independently, because my parents finally kind of cut the cord and said, look, you're going to work for what you need, work for what you want, and really start to build a foundation. And that's really, I couldn't thank my parents enough, because I feel like it really set the tone for where my life would head over the next, you know, up until now, which has been almost 8 years.
So you're clean today, 8 years.
It'll
or not today.
8 years,
but
December 15th.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. It's, you know, I can't wait to put up the pictures, because I think it's hard for our listeners to imagine, but you're absolutely strikingly beautiful.
Thank
29-year-old,
you.
Fit, healthy, blonde, I in a million years wouldn't walk by you on the on Greenwich Avenue and think to myself, oh yeah, she's a recovering heroin addict, right?
Right. Most people don't.
No. And that, you know, unfortunately is what I see, you know, in my practice is the folks who walk in who are struggling with the opioids are, you know, they look like you and me.
Right.
There's just no way to know what's going on. And I have had clients reach out for help saying to their parents, I really need to see a therapist for depression. Oh, come on, get over it. You just have anger management issues. And then they're in my office. And what I'm hearing from a young adult, an 18-year-old, where I can't disclose to the parents because they're 18, is that they're using heroin every single day.
And yeah, that, and that happens stuff. A lot in private practice, and there's a lot of private people in private practice that are able to build that level of confidence with the between them and the client, and then they're able to actually reach out. And I've had many people in private practice reach out to me and say, okay, my client's ready for treatment, and
exactly.
I'm able to help place. And I think that's another big warning sign for parents, too, is that I would strongly advise people who are seeking treatment for their children to talk to a professional and not look online, because you can get placed in a treatment facility that may not be reputable, that may sound really good on the internet, that may say that they have really great reviews, but it's really important to speak with a professional and really reach out and ask for help to find the proper placement for your child.
Absolutely. If how would you say a family should begin that process then? My experience, some of the folks who really know who to guide you to are often at the school social work department, school psychologists, both private and public.
Yep. I think those in private practice, LADCs locally, I mean, mm-hmm. we have such a great wealth of therapists
right.
and psychologists in the Fairfield County area. I mean, always calling Westport House, and you can talk to us directly. You yep. can talk to me directly, and I help families often.
Now, you have two programs. There's ClearPoint Treatment as well, which is intensive outpatient.
Correct.
And that's right. That's right in Westport as well as the living, the Sober Living House. Both programs are for males.
Mm-hmm.
But I've called you and said, you know what, I have a very complex situation with this client, and it's a female. Can we talk it through?
Right.
And you've always been able to be there for me just in terms of as a professional. I know many of the resources. I've traveled around the country to see different rehabs, but you really have your finger on the pulse, and you know who is, you know, what would be the best fit for this client who has extreme anxiety, a little bit of an eating disorder starting to brew, and also is chemically addicted to alcohol.
Yeah, absolutely. In ClearPoint Treatment Center, you know, we do have 5 master's level clinicians and a full-time psychiatrist and medical director. So, you know, I have the ability to bounce things off them as well and ask their opinions. And, you know, so ClearPoint Treatment Center pretty much coincides with our Westport House Transitional Living. And the goal was to add a more a clinical component to be able to make that process a bit more seamless for clients. We were able to utilize local intensive outpatients for a long time, and it just made sense to bring it all under one roof. So everyone's working together, both on the residential side and on the clinical side.
In terms of the contact information, westportsoberhouse.com, of course, is easy to go to. Do you have a primary phone number that we would use?
Yeah, sure. So it would be 203-293-1589, and that will bring you to the main line, and the receptionist can direct you to me, which is at extension 103, or you can go on www.westportsoberhouse.com and fill out a contact us form. It'll get forwarded directly to my email, and I can respond to you that way as well.
And with the IOP, intensive outpatient program, does a client need to first have been at your Sober House, or could someone come from, say, I have them up in Maine at a sober living facility, a residential treatment facility, and then they're coming back here?
Right now our ClearPoint Treatment Center is open for Westport House clients only, and that is to be able to offer that service to the clients in our transitional living, but more than happy to vet that with anybody or triage that case with anybody to see what would be the most appropriate level of care for that person.
Okay, great. And I'll be talking to your director, because we need more IOPs in this area. That's one of our weaknesses, unfortunately, in Fairfield County and
right.
Close to Greenwich, is where do you have a young adult or child go when they need IOP, because every place is so far away.
Right.
So good. Thank you so much. I appreciate your openness and willingness to really come on the air and talk openly about your own journey.
Sure.
And about your family and so forth. What we're going to do is wrap up, but I definitely can. I would love to have you back on the air because
I would
think
love to.
There's so many other aspects of treatment that we could get into.
Sure.
So this is Beth O'Malley. And I am not signing off just yet because I wanted to just touch on a few other things. I recently had interviewed Olga Litvinenko. Did you hear this yet or no?
I don't think
so. Okay, well, I announced it last week, and now it's really super, super, super official. Olga was on the air about a month ago, and we were promoting her because she was representing Greenwich.
Okay.
And she was in – so her history is that she was in Greenwich. She had a sports injury and wasn't able to compete. Now, oftentimes when kids have a serious sports injury and can't compete, different issues come up, like – marijuana abuse.
Right.
She was struggling, you know, more with mood, and she really knew she needed to find something to get her connected and active in life because she couldn't compete anymore in that way. And so she ran for Miss Teen Connecticut and won. Well, 2 weeks ago, she ran for Miss Connecticut and won.
Nice.
Yeah. So we're so excited for Olga. And she will be then now going on, I guess, for Miss America, representing Greenwich, Connecticut, which is so awesome. I would be so excited to say I know of Miss America.
There you go.
So, all right. This is Beth O'Malley, and I just wanted to make that announcement on behalf of Olga. Again, congratulations. And we'll be back next week on Monday afternoon with the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour. Be well with Beth at 1490 WGCH.
You're listening to the voice of Greenwich, 1490 WGCH, Greenwich.